This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Essays of Francis Bacon. Essay 12. Of Boldness. It is a trivial grammar school text, but yet worthy a wise man's consideration. Question was asked of Demosthenes, what was the chief part of an orator? He answered, action. What next? Action. What next again? Action. He said it that knew it best, and had by nature himself no advantage in that he commended. A strange thing that that part of an orator, which is but superficial, and rather the virtue of a player, should be placed so high above those other noble parts of invention, elocution, and the rest, nay, almost alone, as if it were all in all. But the reason is plain. There is in human nature generally more of the fool than of the wise, and therefore those faculties by which the foolish part of men's minds is taken are most potent. Wonderful like is the case of boldness in civil business. What first? Boldness. What second and third? Boldness. And yet boldness is a child of ignorance and baseness, far inferior to other parts. But nevertheless, it doth fascinate and bind hand and foot those that are either shallow in judgment or weak in courage, which are the greatest part. Yea, and prevaileth with wise men at weak times. Therefore we see it hath done wonders in popular states, but with senates and princes less, and moreover upon the first entrance of bold persons into action than soon after. For boldness is an ill keeper of promise. Surely, as there are mountebanks for the natural body, so there are mountebanks for the politic body. Men that undertake great cures, and perhaps have been lucky in two or three experiments, but want the grounds of science, and therefore cannot hold out. Nay, you shall see a bold fellow many times do Mahomet's miracle. Mahomet made the people believe that he would call and heal to him, and from the top of it offer up his prayers for the observers of his law. The people assembled, Mahomet called the hill to come to him again and again. And when the hill stood still, he was never a whit abashed, but said, if the hill will not come to Mahomet, Mahomet will go to the hill. So these men, when they have promised great matters and failed most shamefully, yet if they have the perfection of boldness, they will but slight over it, and make a turn, and no more ado. Certainly to men of great judgment, bold persons are a sport to behold, nay, and to the vulgar also, boldness has somewhat of the ridiculous. For if absurdity be the subject of laughter, doubt you not but great boldness is seldom without some absurdity. Especially, it is a sport to see when a bold fellow is out of countenance, for that puts his face into a most shrunken and wooden posture. As needs it must, for in bashfulness the spirits do a little go and come. But with bold men, upon like occasion, they stand at a stay, like a stale at chess, where it is no mate, but yet the game cannot stir. But this last were fitter for a satire than for a serious observation. This is well to be weighed, that boldness is ever blind, for it seeth not danger and inconveniences. Therefore it is ill in counsel, good in execution. So that the right use of bold persons is, that they never command in chief, but be seconds, and under the direction of others. For in counsel it is good to see dangers, and in execution not to see them, except they be very great. Essay 13. Of Goodness and Goodness of Nature. I take goodness in this sense, the effecting of the weal of men, which is that the Grecians call philanthropia. And the word humanity, as it is used, is a little too light to express it. Goodness I call the habit, and goodness of nature the inclination. This of all virtues and dignities of the mind is the greatest, being the character of the deity, and without it Man is a busy, mischievous, wretched thing, no better than a kind of vermin. Goodness answers to the theological virtue, charity, and admits no excess but error. The desire of power in excess caused the angels to fall. The desire of knowledge in excess caused man to fall. But in charity there is no excess. Neither can angel nor man come in danger by it. The inclination to goodness is imprinted deeply in the nature of man, insomuch that if it issue not towards men, it will take unto other living creatures, as it is seen in the Turks, a cruel people, who nevertheless are kind to beasts, and give alms to dogs and birds. Insomuch, as Buspicius reporteth, a Christian boy in Constantinople had like to have been stoned, for gagging in a waggishness a long-billed fowl. Errors indeed in this virtue of goodness or charity may be committed. The Italians have an ungracious proverb, Tanto buon che val niente, so good that he is good for nothing. And one of the doctors of Italy, Nicholas Machiavel, had the confidence to put in writing, almost in plain terms, that the Christian faith had given up good men in prey to those that are tyrannical and unjust, which he spake because indeed there was never law or sect or opinion did so much magnify goodness as the Christian religion doth. Therefore, to avoid the scandal and the danger both, it is good to take knowledge of the errors of an habit so excellent. Seek the good of other men, but be not in bondage to their faces or fancies, for that is but facility or softness, which taketh an honest mind prisoner. Never give thou Aesop's cock a gem, who would be better pleased and happier if he had had a barleycorn. The example of God teacheth the lesson truly. He sendeth his rain, and maketh his sun to shine, upon the just and unjust. But he doth not rain wealth, nor shine honor and virtues upon men equally. Common benefits are to be communicate with all, but peculiar benefits with choice. And beware how in making the portraiture thou breakest the pattern. For divinity maketh the love of ourselves the pattern, the love of our neighbors but the portraiture. Sell all thou hast, and give it to the poor, and follow me. But sell not all thou hast, except thou come and follow me. That is, except thou have a vocation, wherein thou mayest do as much good, with little means as with great. For otherwise, in feeding the streams, thou driest the fountain. Neither is there only a habit of goodness directed by right reason, but there is in some men, even in nature, a disposition towards it, as on the other side there is a natural malignity. For there be that in their nature do not affect the good of others. The lighter sort of malignity turneth but to crassness, or frowardness, or aptness to oppose, or difficulties, or the like, but the deeper sort to envy and mere mischief. Some men in other men's calamities are, as it were, in season, and are ever on the loading part, not so good as the dogs that licked Lazarus's sores, but like flies that are still buzzing upon anything that is raw. Misanthropy that make it their practice to bring men to the bow, and yet never a tree for the purpose in their gardens as Timon had. Such dispositions are the very errors of human nature, and yet they are the fittest timber to make great politics of, like the knee timber that is good for ships that are ordained to be tossed, but not for building houses that shall stand firm. The parts and signs of goodness are many. If a man be gracious and courteous to strangers, it shows he is a citizen of the world, and that his heart is no island, cut off from other lands, but a continent that joins to them. If he be compassionate towards the afflictions of others, it shows that his heart is like the noble tree, that is wounded itself when it gives the balm. If he easily pardons and remits offenses, it shows that his mind is planted above injuries, so that he cannot be shot. If he be thankful for small benefits, it shows that he weighs men's minds and not their trash. But above all, if he have St. Paul's perfection, that he would wish to be anathema from Christ for the salvation of his brethren, it shows much of a divine nature, and a kind of conformity with Christ himself. Essay 14 of Nobility. We will speak of nobility first as a portion of an estate, then as a condition of particular persons. A monarchy, where there is no nobility at all, is ever a pure and absolute tyranny, as that of the Turks. For nobility attempers sovereignty, and draws the eyes of the people somewhat aside from the royal line. But for democracies they need it not, and they are commonly more quiet, and less subject to sedition, than where there are stirps of nobles. For men's eyes are upon the business, and not upon the persons. Or, if upon the persons, it is for the business's sake, as fittest, and not for flags and pedigree. We see the Switzers last well, notwithstanding their diversity of religion and of cantons. For utility is their bond, and not respects. The United Provinces of the Low Countries in their government excel. For where there is an equality, the consultations are more indifferent, and the payments and tributes more cheerful. A great and potent nobility addeth majesty to a monarch, but diminisheth power, and putteth life and spirit into the people, but presseth their fortune. It is well when nobles are not too great for sovereignty, nor for justice, and yet maintained in that height, as the insolency of inferiors may be broken upon them, before it come on too fast upon the majesty of kings. A numerous nobility causeth poverty, and inconvenience in a state, for it is a surcharge of expense, and besides, it being of necessity that many of the nobility fall, in time, to be weak in fortune, it maketh a kind of disproportion between honor and means. As for nobility in particular persons, it is a reverend thing to see an ancient castle or building not in decay, or to see a fair timber tree sound and perfect. How much more to behold an ancient noble family, which has stood against the waves and weathers of time? For new nobility is but the act of power, but ancient nobility is the act of time. Those that are first raised to nobility are commonly more virtuous, but less innocent than their descendants. For there is rarely any rising but by a commixture of good and evil arts. But it is reason the memory of their virtues remain to their posterity, and their faults die with themselves. Nobility of birth commonly abateth industry, and he that is not industrious envieth him that is. Besides, noble persons cannot go much higher, and he that standeth at a stay when others rise can hardly avoid motions of envy. On the other side, nobility extinguisheth the passive envy from others towards them, because they are in possession of honor. Certainly kings that have able men of their nobility shall find ease in employing them, and a better slide into their business. For people naturally bend to them as born in some sort to command. Essay 15 of Seditions and Troubles. Shepherds of people had need know the calendars of tempest in state, which are commonly greatest when things grow to equality, as natural tempests are greatest about the equinoctia. And as there are certain hollow blasts of wind, and secret swellings of seas before a tempest, so are there in states. Illi etiam caecos instare tumultus. Sepe monet, fraudesque et aperta, tunescere bella. Libels and licentious discourses against the state, when they are frequent and open, and in like sort false news often running up and down to the disadvantage of the state, and hastily embraced, are amongst the signs of trouble. Virgil, giving the pedigree of fame, saith, she was sister to the giants. Elam terra parens, ira irritata diorum, extremum ut perabent, co inceladoci sororem progenuit. As if fames were the relics of sedition past, but they are no less indeed the preludes of seditions to come. Howsoever he noteth it right, that seditious tumults and seditious fames differ no more but as brother and sister, masculine and feminine, especially if it come to that, that the best actions of a state, and the most plausible, and which ought to give greatest contentment, are taken in ill sense and traduced. For that shows the envy great, as Tacitus saith, conflata magna invidia, sue bene, sue mali, gesta primunt. Neither doth it follow that because these fames are a sign of troubles, that the suppressing of them with too much severity should be a remedy of troubles. For the despising of them many times checks them best, and the going about to stop them doth but make a wonder long lived. Also, that kind of obedience which Tacitus speaketh of is to be held suspected, errant in officio, sed tamen qui malent mandata imperantium interpretari quam exequi. Disputing, excusing, cavilling upon mandates and directions is a kind of shaking off the yoke and assay of disobedience, especially if in those disputings they which are for the direction speak fearfully and tenderly, and those that are against it audaciously. Also, as Machiavel noteth well, when princes that ought to be common parents make themselves as a party and lean to a side, it is as a boat that is overthrown by uneven weight on the one side, as was well seen in the time of Henry the Third of France, for first himself entered league for the extirpation of the Protestants, and presently after the same league was turned upon himself. For when the authority of princes is made but an accessory to a cause, and that there be other bands that tie faster than the band of sovereignty, kings begin to be put almost out of possession. Also, when discords and quarrels and factions are carried openly and audaciously, it is a sign the reverence of government is lost. For the motions of the greatest persons in a government ought to be as the motions of the planets under primum mobile, according to the old opinion, which is that every of them is carried swiftly by the highest motion, and softly in their own motion. And therefore, when great ones in their own particular motion move violently, and, as Tacitus expresseth it well, liberius quam ut imperantium meminiscent, it is a sign that the orbs are out of frame. For reverence is that wherewith princes are girt from God, who threateneth the dissolving thereof. Solvum singula regum. So when any of the four pillars of government are mainly shaken or weakened, which are religion, justice, counsel, and treasure, men had need to pray for fair weather. But let us pass from this part of predictions, concerning which, nevertheless, more light may be taken from that which followeth. And let us speak first of the materials of seditions, then of the motives of them, and thirdly of the remedies. Concerning the materials of seditions, it is a thing well to be considered, for the surest way to prevent seditions, if the times do bear it, is to take away the matter of them. For if there be fuel prepared, it is hard to tell whence the spark shall come that shall set it on fire. The matter of seditions is of two kinds, much poverty and much discontentment. It is certain, so many overthrown estates, so many votes for troubles. Lucian noteth well the state of Rome before the civil war. Hinc usura vorax, rapidum qui in tempore fainus. Hinc concusa fides, et multis utili bellum. This same multis utili bellum is an assured and infallible sign of a state disposed to seditions and troubles. And if this poverty and broken estate in the better sort be joined with a want and necessity in the mean people, the danger is imminent and great. For the rebellions of the belly are the worst. As for discontentments, they are, in the politic body, like the humors in the natural, which are apt to gather a preternatural heat and to inflame. And let no prince measure the danger of them by this, whether they be just or unjust. for that were to imagine people to be too reasonable, who do often spurn their own good. Nor yet by this, whether the griefs whereupon they rise be in fact great or small. For they are the most dangerous discontentments, where the fear is greater than the feeling. Dolendi modus, timendi non itim. Besides, in great oppressions, the same things that provoke the patience do withal mate the courage. But in fears it is not so. Neither let any prince or state be secure concerning discontentments, because they have been often, or have been long, and yet no peril hath ensued. For as it is true that every vapor or fume doth not turn into a storm, so it is nevertheless true that storms, though they blow over diverse times, yet may fall at last. And as the Spanish proverb noteth well, the cord breaketh at the last by the weakest pull. The causes and motives of seditions are innovation in religion, taxes, alteration of laws and customs, breaking of privileges, general oppression, advancement of unworthy persons, strangers, dearths, disbanded soldiers, factions grown desperate, and whatsoever in offending people joineth and knitteth them in a common cause. For the remedies, there may be some general preservatives whereof we will speak. As for the just cure, it must answer to the particular disease, and so be left to counsel rather than rule. The first remedy or prevention is to remove, by all means possible, that material cause of sedition whereof we spake, which is want and poverty in the estate. To which purpose serveth the opening and well-balancing of trade, the cherishing of manufactures, the banishing of idleness, the repressing of waste and excess by sumptuary laws, the improvement and husbanding of the soil, the regulating of prices of things vendible, the moderating of taxes and tributes, and the like. Generally it is to be foreseen that the population of a kingdom, especially if it be not mown down by wars, do not exceed the stock of the kingdom which should maintain them. Neither is the population to be reckoned only by number, for a smaller number that spend more and earn less do wear out an estate sooner than a greater number that live lower and gather more. Therefore the multiplying of nobility and other degrees of quality in an over proportion to the common people doth speedily bring a state to necessity, and so doth likewise an overgrown clergy, for they bring nothing to the stock, and in like manner when more are bred scholars than preferments can take off. It is likewise to be remembered that forasmuch as the increase of any estate must be upon the foreigner, for whatsoever is somewhere gotten is somewhere lost, there be but three things which one nation selleth unto another: the commodity as nature yieldeth it, the manufacture, and the vecture or carriage. So that if these three wheels go, wealth will flow as in a spring tide. And it cometh many times to pass that materium superabit opus, that the work and the carriage is more worth than the material, and enricheth a state more, as is notably seen in the low countrymen, who have the best minds above ground in the world. Above all things, good policy is to be used, that the treasure and monies in a state be not gathered into few hands, for otherwise a state may have a great stock, and yet starve. And money is like muck, not good except it be spread. This is done chiefly by suppressing, or at least keeping a straight hand, upon the devouring trades of usury, engrossing great pasturages, and the like. For removing discontentments, or at least the danger of them, there is in every state, as we know, two portions of subjects, the noblesse and the commonalty. When one of these is discontent, the danger is not great, for common people are of slow motion, if they be not excited by the greater sort, and the greater sort are of small strength, except the multitude be apt and ready to move of themselves. Then is the danger, when the greater sort do but wait for the troubling of the waters amongst the meaner, that then they may declare themselves. The poets feign that the rest of the gods would have bound Jupiter, which he hearing of by the council of Pallas, sent for Briareus, with his 100 hands, to come in to his aid, as an emblem, no doubt, to show how safe it is for monarchs to make sure of the goodwill of common people. To give moderate liberty for griefs and discontentments to evaporate, so it be without too great insolency or bravery, is a safe way. For he that turneth the humours back, and maketh the wound bleed inwards, endangereth malign ulcers, and pernicious imposthumations. The part of Epimetheus ought well become Prometheus, in the case of discontentments, for there is not a better provision against them. Epimetheus, when griefs and evils flew abroad, at last shut the lid, and kept hope in the bottom of the vessel. Certainly the politic and artificial nourishing and entertaining of hopes, and carrying men from hopes to hopes, is one of the best antidotes against the poison of discontentments. And it is a certain sign of a wise government and proceeding, when it can hold men's hearts by hopes, when it cannot by satisfaction. And when it can handle things in such manner, as no evil shall appear so peremptory, but that it hath some outlet of hope, which is the less hard to do, because both particular persons and factions are apt enough to flatter themselves, or at least to brave that which they believe not. Also the foresight and prevention, that there be no likely or fit head whereinto discontented persons may resort, and under whom they may join, is a known but an excellent point of caution. I understand a fit head to be one that hath greatness and reputation, that hath confidence with the discontented party, and upon whom they turn their eyes, and that is thought discontented in his own particular. Which kind of persons are either to be won and reconciled to the state, and that in a fast and true manner, or to be fronted with some other of the same party that may oppose them, and so divide the reputation. Generally the dividing and breaking of all factions and combinations that are adverse to the state, and setting them at distance, or at least distrust amongst themselves, is not one of the worst remedies. For it is a desperate case, if those that hold with the proceeding of the state be full of discourse and faction, and those that are against it be entire and united. I have noted that some witty and sharp speeches which have fallen from princes have given fire to seditions. Caesar did himself infinite hurt in that speech, Sylla nescivit literas non potuit dictare, for it did utterly cut off that hope which men had entertained, that he would at one time or other give over his dictatorship. Galba undid himself by that speech, legi a si militim non imi, for it put the soldiers out of hope of the donative. Probus likewise, by that speech, si vixero non opus erit amplius Romano imperio militibus, a speech of great despair for the soldiers, and many the like. Surely princes had need, in tender matters and ticklish times, to beware what they say, especially in these short speeches, which fly abroad like darts, and are thought to be shot out of their secret intentions. For as for large discourses, they are like flat things, and not so much noted. Lastly, let princes against all events not be without some great person, one or rather more, of military valor near unto them, for the repressing of seditions in their beginnings. For without that, there useth to be more trepidation in court upon the first breaking out of troubles than were fit. And the state runneth the danger of that which Tacitus saith, acte is habitus animorum fuit, ut pessimum fascinus aderent posse plures velent omnes paterenter. But let such military persons be assured and well reputed of, rather than factious and popular, holding also good correspondence with the other great men in the state, or else the remedy is worse than the disease. End of The Essays of Francis Bacon, Chapters 12, 13, 14, and 15.